This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement, the podcast, and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we'll be discussing. Today, I am joined by no other than the Kate Ranta. I am deeply excited to welcome you to the podcast today. And for those who do not know, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we are doing a series highlighting survivors, highlighting the ongoing epidemic of gun violence, domestic violence, and intersectionality thereof in our communities, and recognizing the need for common sense gun legislation. So without further ado, Kate, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So let's jump right in. Okay. And you are a survivor. You're an advocate for, you know, ending the gun violence epidemic. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, you're also a published author, and you wrote a book called Killing Kate. Yep. Now, I first learned about your story on a TV show, and I believe it was called 911 Panic. Is the show that I learned about your story, and I knew that I had to reach out to you. And ever since then, we've connected, we keep in contact, and you've been such a positive light on such a negative subject.
if that
actually is possible, which I believe it is, because we have to have these conversations, because these conversations are literally life-changing and life-saving. And recognizing the ongoing need to have these conversations and about those rippling effects that violence has on, like, in and on our communities, especially marginalized communities.
That's right.
It leaves those rippling effects that linger for literally years. And you're not immune to it. I'm not immune to it. I recognize it. I live in Kansas City, where 19 of the last homicides in the Kansas City city limits more domestic violence related also involved a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love for you to walk us through your journey, because Killing Kate is more than just a book. There is a whole story behind that.
Right. It's so more than what happened to me. it shows that, you know, I'm a real person, and these things can happen, and, you know, we don't ask for it.
Absolutely. So walk us through your journey. Walk us through who Kate Ranta is. And for those of you who do not know, she can go on a rant, and I am here for this. It's not just in her name.
Rant and Raven.
But we are so excited to welcome you to the podcast. Feel free to walk us through your journey, my friend.
Sure. Where would you like me to start? My story, if we just go from like start to finish, can take like, honestly, 3.5 hours. So do we want to start kind of like where I was, like who I was when I met my abuser?
And yes.
Okay. Yes. So I was a single mom living in the Washington, D.C. area in 2007. And I had friends that were sort of joining online dating, and it was pretty fairly new back then, in the 2000s, like the whole online dating thing. And I hadn't done it before. And, you know, I was like, well, it had been like almost 3 years since I had broken up with my older son's father. And, I felt kind of ready, and so I joined. It was actually pre-match.com. It was like Yahoo Personals or something like that. And I just was clicking on guys that, looked attractive and successful and, that I might match with. And Tom, who wound up being my abuser, was one of the, if not the first that I talked to. Everything went really fast with him. That's probably one of the, I would say, early red flags that I just didn't recognize, because at that point I didn't really understand anything about intimate partner violence, coercive control, all these terms and phrases and words that I have, the understanding about. But we moved really, really fast. I think he asked me to be his girlfriend within days. He asked me to move in within 3 months, proposed, and I was pregnant with our son within the first 6 months. And at the time, I thought it was romantic. I was 34 going on 35, and he's 5 years older than me. He was a captain in the Air Force, successful. He had like 20 plus years in the military. I thought we were on the same page, I wanted a husband, I wanted more children. And it didn't seem that red flaggy to me at the time. It seemed romantic, that we wanted to go on this journey together and we wanted the same things out of life. So it didn't seem wrong on any level to me. But pretty quickly, of course, looking back, hindsight's always 2020, right? When I look back on sort of some of his behaviors early on, I can see it now, where at the time I didn't. And that's not my fault, right? Like, I just didn't have the resources and tools and awareness. People really weren't talking about various types of domestic violence. I mean, I think it's gotten better, now in 2025, but 2007 and previous to that, like, basically it was like, if a guy hits you, that's bad. That's bad. If a guy, yells at you and calls you names, that's bad. But sort of just controlling type behaviors and the more like insidious types of abuse, even financial abuse, nobody was talking about that. So I didn't know. Big example I usually give is like all of my friends and family were getting on Facebook, probably like around 2007, 2008. It was more than just like college students at that point. And I remember he like discouraged me slash like really kind of refused to, quote, allow me to go on Facebook, saying that his therapist had told him that it's opens a window for infidelity, like that, former classmate, male classmates of mine might try to hit me up and what caused me to cheat, And so I remember I wouldn't really take it. Like, I would be like, well, that doesn't really make sense. Like, I have to be a willing participant in that, like, you have to either trust me or not. It just didn't make any sense to me. And then I wound up sort of maneuvering around it, saying, well, I really want to join, so I'll be friends with family members and like the only men I'll be friends with are like family members, and then female friends from other parts of my life. And he agreed to that, but then he like demanded that if any men outside of my family tried to friend request me, I needed to tell him about it. And so I complied with that, for a little bit, and it would just caused a argument every single time. Even though I was like denying them, I would tell him, and it would cause, some kind of drama over Facebook, like over the fact that I'm on Facebook. And so I honestly just stopped telling him. I didn't accept the friend request, but I stopped telling him because I knew, I was learning that that's what it would mean. You know what I'm saying? So let's see. Zachary, it's really long. Like, what direction do you want me to go?
I think, talking about the online dating portion, so you mentioned about that, and this sounds like one of the stories that, I relate to very deeply is, and one of my close friends went through this, and it's like one of those that coercive control aspect is so oftentimes overlooked because they think whenever it's a man and a wife or, whoever, because we know it's not binary, we know that, but it's one of those things and those mind tricks and that mind controlling, like if I can't have you, nobody else can. And
Correct. Yep.
it's one of those that manipulative control and that coercive control and the financial control. And it's just, oh my God. Like I grew up in like a not necessarily like that specific, but it was kind of like that, but not nearly to that level.
And the difficult part is that it's not like everything was bad. I'm in a place now where we're coming up on 13 years, so I've had a lot of therapy and a lot of time to process this. And yes, I can give and I can give more examples, but the thing that I really like had a block about for so long is that the idea that like not everything was bad all the time.
Because there were some good times too,
Obviously I
right?
would write. I wouldn't have, I mean, again, it was fast and it didn't last very long. I mean, it all fell apart within 3 years, but still, like within that's still a chunk of time. Like, so within those 3 years, like we had inside jokes, we laughed, we, did all the normal things that normal couples do, and he wasn't physically abusing me. Until it really unraveled, I didn't know that I was in an emotionally abusive and psychologically abusive relationship. Like a big example is when we got married, we went to Vegas and got married in March of 08, and I was already pregnant. And we were driving, like the next morning we went and got brunch and everything was fine, and got in the car to go, like back to the hotel or something. And he's just driving and just very casually says, I went through the steps in my head about how I would kill my ex-wife at when she like cheated on me and broke up with me and broke up and we got divorced. Just all very matter of fact. And anybody hearing that, anybody listening to that would be like, I would have been out of there immediately, Like what? But the way it was delivered and the context of it all, it's like, okay, I had just married this guy. Like, I had just married him. I was pregnant with his child. And I didn't feel like scared when he said it. I felt more confused. Like, what are you talking about? And I was like, I mean, I've gotten divorced before and I've like had people, broken up, like had really other relationships break up. Like, I never thought about like harming anybody that I've ever been with. What are you talking about? And he was like, well, again, my therapist said that that's sort of a normal processing thing. And of course, I didn't do it, but I thought about that I would put her like in the trunk of the car and like kidnap her and put her in the trunk of the car. And I mean, just driving down the road. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound. I was like, I don't know. I don't really quite get that. Like, I don't understand that. And then we just probably like changed the subject, but that kind of stuck with me because now in retrospect, it was definitely a threat, right? Like he was telling me basically if I leave him, he might
think about and or do the same thing to me. Because he was also at the same time bragging about having like stalked her and taken like a stereo equipment that he had like installed in her car, that he like stalked her to her new apartment and like ripped the stereo equipment out of her car, that kind of stuff. He was telling me about like bragging about it. So again, you think about these things and like other people hear these stories and are like, well, what's wrong with, I guess, the victim, in my case, woman in this situation? Like, why wouldn't she just leave? Why would she, she hears these things and she's like being controlled and why doesn't she just leave? And that's always to me one of the most offensive questions that anybody can ask somebody that's in my situation and anybody that's in a situation like mine, because it's not that easy. Luckily for me, I have an amazing family, amazing parents, wonderful friends. Nobody turned their backs on me. I had a great support system when I needed to leave. I was working. I have an education, a job. Like, there's so many in people in my shoes that don't have that support. They're completely dependent on their abuser, and it's not that easy to just leave, and especially when you have kids. Because the systems are set up for basically protecting the abuser. Like, you can lose your kids. I say all the time that if he hadn't done what he did, if he had, if he hadn't ambushed us and tried to kill me, he would have dragged me. I would probably, my son's 17 now. We would probably still be in court.
And I think that is, a pivotal moment, where we can shift and kind of talk about, what led up to this specific instance of him literally trying to kill you, but not just you. There's others that were involved too. And I know enough about your story, and I'm excited to say I'm excited to hear this. That sounds completely wrong, but what I mean is, like I said, I've seen your story on television. I've heard about your book. I've read reviews about your book. I'm going to purchase it, I promise. And then one of these days, I'm going to have you sign it.
Yay. Happily.
But I think hearing you actually talk about it, directly in this format is different because it's,
It
I can actually hear it in real time, right?
Correct.
So.
It's not watching it on TV. There can it feel a little bit of a I don't know what word I'm looking for. It's just a little more intimate when having a conversation about it.
Yes. So feel free to walk us through what led up to that
Sure.
specific
So
moment.
basically, we were living on an army base in Virginia, just outside of DC. He was going to be retiring, and we were making plans. Actually, having a house built in Parkland, Florida. My parents were living there, and my brother was living in the town next door, Coral Springs. And I'm very, very close with my parents and my family, and I wanted to be near them. And so, we were going along making these plans, and once we got down there, I always say that's when the shit really hit the fan. Like, once the military didn't have, quote, control over him, he had gotten his pension, his disability, he was all kind of set and separating from the military. Everything unraveled literally within the first, like, 3 months of us living in Parkland in this brand new house that we had bought a plot of land. There's a brand new community in Parkland. Like, it was everything that I would have wanted, and yeah, he had become, oh, I should backtrack just real quick. Early on when we were dating, he got in this motorcycle accident, like just outside DC. And he was actually supposed to deploy to Iraq within the first like 3 months that I was with him. And that motorcycle accident caused him to not be deployed. But he had a lot of like physical therapy and all this stuff, and the military was really giving him like Percocets and Oxys, like in these big bottles, like candy, I always say. So he got really very, very addicted to pain pills. He would call the ambulance all the time, quote about his back, and go in the hospital to get like IVs. It was really, but I was like really in denial about it, like how bad it really, really was. And this is no excuse for his behavior because he would have been like this anyway, but it just added to the craziness of the situation. So once we got to Florida, yeah, he was like heavily addicted to pain pills, and it just felt like this tornado of like chaos around me in the house, and I'm trying to just tame and keep everything calm, and like it was, I don't even, it was really nothing I had ever experienced before. So what actually broke everything was that one night, so it would have been, this would be like January of 2011, like right after New Year's. He was in my older son's room. They were playing video games, and I was like on Facebook or something, and I came in laughing about a comment that I had seen, like some guy I had graduated from high school with on another girl's post. And I told him why I was laughing, and then his face got just like dark, you know? And he literally just like got up and left the house. And I knew, I knew. So I knew he was pissed. So then he just started blowing up my phone for hours and hours and hours, like probably 3 to 4 hours, saying that he was like at strip clubs and was so drunk, and all these women were all over him. And I was just like livid, and I was like, you know, do not come home. Like, if you're gonna be like this, like, just don't even bother to come home. Well, I mean, he wasn't gonna listen to me. So he came in, and he went straight into the like our bedroom and closed and locked, like slammed and locked the door. And I went up, I started crying like on the couch, and I went over to the door, and I heard like ch -ch -ch, like one of his guns cocking, I guess. And I thankfully had my phone, so I ran to the front of the house and like opened the door and was on the stoop, and I called 911. And I mean, I was convinced he was going to come out and shoot me. And my thought, I actually thought, like, I'm going to go outside because if this happens, I want a neighbor to hear it. Like, I want somebody to hear it, you know? So it's so like surreal to think how your brain works in this situation. So then all of a sudden the garage door opens up, and he walked out with our son, Will, who was only two. He took him out of his crib and got in the car, in the truck, and like put Will on his lap. And my thought, without even really thinking, I just like jumped in the car. My instinct was to get in the car and protect my son, you know? So he peeled out of the driveway and like drove crazy up the street. And then he like at the stop sign, he slammed on the brakes, and then he raised his fist. And now this is the first, he'd never threatened ever to put his hands on me before. Raised his fist and was like, "Get out of this fucking car right now, or I'll punch you in your fucking face." And I'd never seen, I really like had never seen his face like this. Like, eyes were like black, you know, and he has blue eyes. Like, it was terrifying, really. I listened. I jumped out, and he like peeled around the corner, and then I started running through the neighborhood, like screaming at the top of my lungs, like, "He has my baby! He has my baby! Somebody help me! Somebody help me!" And like, not one person in the community came out. Not one. I couldn't. I mean, yes, it was the middle of the night, but like, you could, there were cars and driveways. Like, people would wake up if there was a woman like screaming at the top of her lungs. I'm not quiet, not one person. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna go back to the house because my older son was there. He was sleeping, and he was only like five, so I got back, and police were there because I had called 911. And what happened was Tom went around the block and came back because he knew that I had called police. So he got back and got William back in his crib before the cops arrived. So when I run back, Matt, and you can imagine the scenario, like, I'm hysterically crying, traumatized, never been through anything like this before in my entire life. I've never seen abuse before. I had no idea what. So I come, I'm a mess. I'm crying. I'm sweating. I'm hysterical. And he's there, cool and calm. He had these military coins that they trade like within their units. He had a whole bunch of them. And he like was taking the coins and like giving them to the police and buddying up with them and talking about being this military veteran and like Iraq war veteran, and he'd never deployed ever, so he was lying to them. And then, I'm there hysterical. So one cop pulled me aside and was like, he was a little older, and he was like, "If I've seen this before. If he didn't do it this time, he will do it next time. Like, he will hit you next time." So I would go tomorrow to the courthouse in Fort Lauderdale and apply for a restraining order. And so that's what I did. But the caveat is that the police that night made me call my parents, which I called them hysterically crying, to come get my sons and me to go stay at their house and let him stay at our house. Like, I had to like get these small children, and I'm hysterically crying, into the car with my parents, and they allowed him to stay at the house. They didn't tell him to like get lost and go, to a hotel, let the mother and the children stay in the house. No, they let, I just, when I think about it, I still get enraged all these years later, because it's like, what were they even thinking? So fast forward, I go to the courthouse with my dad the next day, apply for a restraining order. I was issued a temporary. He was served. And then at the time he was served, I was told that police could take all of the guns that he had in the house. And he had a lot of guns. I'm not, my parents are educators. I've never been around military. I didn't grow up military with hunting. Like, we didn't do that. And so I didn't grow up with guns, and he did. And when we got together, I just thought it was like, okay, well, I mean, he's in the military. It's a culture thing, and just keep them locked up. And I wasn't scared in the sense of like threatened. I wasn't threatened about them being in the house so much, like, as a threat to me. I wasn't comfortable with them. I'm not a fan, but I wasn't going to insist that he get rid of them. Anyway, so under the temporary restraining order, he is allowed to, or they're allowed to go in and take the weapons. So they asked me where he kept them. He kept them in the master bedroom closet. And so they wound up taking, it was like two shot. He had more than I even knew. It was like a couple of shotguns, several, like many handguns. And you think that that would make me feel safer, no, at that point, knowing that he didn't, that they had taken his weapons. But what they said to my dad and me was that he could go out the next day and buy another gun, because even though he had he was served a temporary restraining order, he wasn't convicted of anything. So there was nothing that would hit any of the systems that would not allow him to get a gun. So tell me how that makes sense, that they can take his guns and okay, that's great, but then the next day he can legally go out and buy another gun. Like, I'm not, I, that's, that doesn't make any sense. That's like not common sense gun laws, right? So, I was doing everything that you're supposed to do when you just leave, right? Like I didn't, he threatened violence and I left and I went and got a restraining order like they told me to do, and I still was in danger. And that's what he did. He did, yeah, I did find out that he did go out and get a gun legally after after those weapons were taken. So we were separated for like 8 months or so. And I was in a really bad place after those 8 months. Like, I couldn't afford the mortgage of our house, and this is where the financial abuse comes in, right? So I couldn't afford the life that we had worked for and established for ourselves. I couldn't afford the monthly mortgage. I couldn't afford my car payment. He stopped when we separated. He stopped paying for things. I really was struggling, and I had gone back to court many times throughout those 8 months to try to get the temporary made permanent, and the judge would never do it. He just kept extending the temporary and saying, you two are going to have to be civil to each other at some point because of this child that you have, like as if I had done something wrong. I was just trying to keep us safe and wanted to get away from this scary person. And the judge was treating it like we were both the problem. And that was bullshit, like I hadn't done anything. I just wanted to get out and be safe, So then what happened was he wound up contacting me, and like sucking up and saying it was just a bad night that night. Like, it'll never happen again. I just want us to be a family. I want to be there with you and Will. And, like, I'm not taking pills anymore. And, I have my pension and disability, and I am up for this six-figure, contracting job. So you can quit your job and raise Will, full time, be a stay-at-home mom, all of these promises. And I'll throw a statistic. So the statistic is that it takes a victim like 7 tries. I think it's, yeah, like 7 tries to leave a domestic violence relationship. And I fell back once. I took him back because it just, I wanted those things too. I didn't, I thought, okay, well, maybe it was, I blamed the pills or something. I was like, if the pills probably, were a part of this situation, and if he's clean, and he, of course, he still loves me. He loves his son. Like, we can make this work. My parents and my family, my brother, my friends were like horrified that I was taking him back. Not in a mean way, in a very like concerned and scared way, and rightfully so. But they stuck by me. They didn't turn away. thank God, because it all fell apart again within like 3 months after I took him back. He essentially, real quick, he gave our son some sort of medication that made him hallucinate. And I called 911 and paramedics came and a sheriff came because of like our house was flagged because of the past domestic violence. And when we were at the hospital with my son, the sheriff like motioned for me to come over to him. He was standing at the nurse's station and he would like just very quietly was like, is everything okay at home? And I was like, no. And he said, okay, when you get back from the hospital, there's going to be a child protective services investigator there and she's going to help get you out. So we weren't, when the blood results came back from the test they did on Will, they weren't really able to determine what he gave. I still don't, you know, it's been so long. I mean, this, I don't even remember really looking at like the hospital records or anything. It was all such a whirlwind. But I know my son and he was hallucinating and he gave him something. But thankfully he was okay. And sure enough, we got home and the investigator was there. She separated us, which is good protocol because let's not interview me right in front of him, which I think too many officers and investigators do with victims and perpetrators, which I wouldn't have said the same things in front of him that I did when she, you know, pulled us apart. So she took me in the other room and she was like, I know there's been another incident. I'm paraphrasing. It's like, you know, dangerous. Like, I want you to pack a bag for yourself and for your son and go to your parents. And if I find out that you get back with him, I'm taking your son because this is a dangerous situation. And that was it sounds like, whoa, like, oh my gosh, but it was exactly what I needed. It was the out that I needed because, you know, I was able to say, well, the investigator said, I can't be around you. So it wasn't all on me having to leave. Does that make sense? Like,
it does. It makes sense.
Yeah. Like I was able to say, cause he did. I mean, I didn't have a restraining order at that point when I left and the second time. So he, of course, was like emailing me and texting me and all this stuff. And I trying to get me to come home. And I'm like, I can't, and I didn't want to. And I was like, I can't, because they're going to take William. If I come back, she's going to find out. And, you know, they're checking in, like, you know, they press charges, the state pressed charges against Tom for endangering William with whatever you gave him. So I was like, I can't come back. And so then that set off a whole nother like 8 to 9 month period where he was put on this like plan where he had like anger management classes to complete and parenting classes, and they would do random like drug testing. And there was, you know, a 10-point checklist of things that he had to accomplish before he would get unsupervised visitation with Will again. And he was avoiding all of it through his lawyer. Like they kept arguing about like that he doesn't need to do this or that, or, you know, they were trying to cut corners. And, you know, what really pisses me off is that at the end of like 9 months, the representative from CPS, not the investigator, but we had like a representative that would come in every month to my house, by the way, which I had no charges and I hadn't done anything, but I had to deal with this, you know, representative coming in the house every month and taking pictures of Will and, you know, checking my refrigerator and, you know, making sure that Will has what he needs when I'm not the one with the charges. You know, it was infuriating and ridiculous. You know, the charges were against him. So at the end of the 9 months, she was like, let me ask you this, because we're looking to close the case. Do you think that Tom would actually hurt William? And I was like, well, I don't know. And I said, but I believe I'm the target. And Will is, at the time, like, he was just turning 4. And I was like, he's with me all the time. He's basically a baby. Like, he's just a little, he's 4. So if I'm the target and he comes after me, like, yeah, he's in danger. Like, he's in danger because he's with me. And she's like, oh, okay. But then, yeah, we had to go to court and the magistrate closed the case. By the way, he had not even finished his entire, like, the 10 steps that he had to take. He didn't even finish it. They were just like, oh, he presents so well and he seems like such a good father. Having observed him super, with supervised visits, he's such a good father and presents so well and he's intelligent and all of this stuff. So, we're going to close the case. It was absolutely insane. Even with the drug testing, they were like, well, he has prescriptions for it, so I mean, make it make sense. He was abusing pain pills again and driving high with our son, but whatever, he's got prescriptions for it, so that's not going to count against him. It was absolutely bonkers. So the magistrate was like, I'll never forget when she closed the case. Our divorce had stalled during this whole like CPS process, and we had no like legal visitation schedule, nothing signed by a judge in place. And I like begged the magistrate to please just do like a temporary visitation schedule that he has to follow, because I have nothing. Like, once this closes and he has access, unsupervised access to Will, and I have nothing to fall on. He could basically kidnap him. And she was like, nope. Like, she was such a bitch. And she was like, I feel bad for this kid with you two as parents. Like, as if I had done, again, like as if I had done something wrong. It's,
Wait, wait, wait,
it
wait,
was.
wait, 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 wait. Hold on. Pause right there. So you said that she tried to blame you and also tried to state that, oh my God, Kate.
Yeah, it's
So this is
like,
literally the system working by design, is exactly what that is.
I know, and I'm one of thousands and thousands of protective parents
Oh my
that
God.
go through this. Like, I just remember bawling. We were in these like close quarters in her like chamber or whatever, around this table, and I was like, I had my lawyer, and by the way, I didn't even have to really be there. I was there like as a protective parent of William. Like, I was showing up, and I hadn't done anything wrong. I had no charges. Like, and she, I feel bad for you, for this kid with you two as parents. I'll never forget it. I just cried. And I knew it. I knew the shit was gonna absolutely hit the fan, because he could do whatever he wanted. I had nothing legal. So, that was September of 2012, the end of September 2012, when the CPS case closed. So my lawyer reached out to his lawyer about like getting a visitation schedule in place. In the meantime, his lawyer was like, well, my client wants to take him to like Disney World like this weekend. He really hadn't seen Will at all. Like, I was like, can we take it slow? Like, this is like, I don't think it's appropriate for him to take him, out of the area. Will doesn't even really know him. But there was nothing legal stopping him, and that's what he did. I didn't know if he would return him. He took him to freaking Disney World, like the first weekend. It was like days after the case closed. It was horrifying. I don't even know how I survived that, like, mentally, because I didn't know. I really didn't know if he was going to return with him or not. And there was nothing that anybody could really do about it because there was nothing legal. We had no documentation. So I just had to somehow trust that this lunatic was going to return my son. So he messed with me that whole weekend. Like he kept sending like pictures of Will. There's one that like always sticks on in my head where Will looks like distressed and he's holding like a bag of candy and there's like a hotel curtain behind him. It was just really like I showed it to my mother and she like screamed. Like we really thought that like maybe he wasn't coming back. And then he was like, I hired a babysitter here at Disney World to watch him. I'm going out. Just fucking with me the whole weekend. And I mean, thank God he did. He returned him. But it's just further abuse, right? And there was nothing I could do to stop it. I was completely helpless. So fast forward a few weeks. It was my birthday, which is October 22nd coming up. It was my 40th birthday, October 22nd of 2012. And he had a visitation that day and he needed to return him by like, I want to say 6 p.m. And we were going over my parents to celebrate my birthday. And he started like messing with me, in the early afternoon of the day, saying like he's getting to be held up and he's like somewhere like he's traffic or was something and he's not going to make it back by 6 and he doesn't know what time he's going to be back. Like, and I'm at work. Like I'm trying to have a stable life and it's just continued abuse basically. So long story short, he did show up, but he was late. I had called the police. They said they were basically like, he could be like halfway to Canada, and there's like nothing we can do because you don't have anything from the court. So, they were still there when he pulled up, and I remember standing in front of his car, and my dad was with me, and my dad was helping Will out of the car, and I stood in front of his car, just like glared at him, and he glared at me like it was like I'm gonna kill you. His face was so scary, and I was like, oh, but I was like infuriated, I was so mad, but and then but I didn't like, I don't know. I still didn't think that he would take it to the level that he did. Things were escalating. I was definitely looking over my shoulder. We were all worried about a possible attack, but I kept saying, he's too much of a coward to actually like do anything. He doesn't want to go to he doesn't like he doesn't want to go to prison. I really thought that, like I said, when we started this podcast, that he was going to just keep messing with me through court, and just keep dragging out custody stuff. That's what I thought he was going to do. I was like, I don't think he's going to really try to physically come after me. And that was, it was honestly underestimating what he was capable of, that. And there's a level of denial that I always try to tell victims now, all these years later, if I'm talking with or if I any message to victims would be like, please don't underestimate what they're capable of because you think that they won't do it, but guess what? So November 2nd of 2012. Our CPS investigator, so the lady who had said, if you get back with him, I'm taking your son. I had called her after the birthday incident and said, told her what happened. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. He had called her, or he had called in a false child abuse report on me between October 22nd and November 2nd. Our CPS investigator recognized the situation, contacted me, and was like, I need to come over and look at Will because this call came in, but I know like everything's fine. So she came. I had to leave work. Go, again, like this is financial abuse. I could have been fired, Got Will. She came over and I told her what had happened with the Disney World thing. And she was like, when they closed the case against him, the CPS case, you have full physical custody, right? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, okay, I'm going to call him and tell him he can't see his son until there's something in writing, like there's something legal. So that's what she did. So it was the first time that somebody was holding him accountable on some level and telling him no. And, and that he had, quote, like lost something in a way, where he wasn't going to be able to see Will. He wasn't going to be able to do whatever he wanted, because she was like, nope. Kate has full physical custody until you guys have like a some sort of settlement. You're not seeing your son. So, yeah, about like 10 days after that, so November 2nd, 2012, I had worked like just my normal day. I had dinner plans that evening, so I, left work, went to Will's daycare, picked him up. Went back to, I had moved to a new apartment like 2 weeks previous to that because Tom was supposed to take over the house and I wanted to live in like a gated community where I, felt safer. And I hadn't given him the address, by the way. So went back to the apartment. I mean, there were still boxes. I hadn't even fully unpacked. And got ready to go out, took Will back out to the car when it was time and turned the car on and all like the lights came on the dashboard and it said low tire pressure, which I was like, oh shit. Like I knew it was him. I was like, he was behind it somehow because during our separation, he had vandalized my car and my dad's car in my parents' driveway. Like he had let the tire pressure out and like ripped like the air conditioning system out of my car, slashed my dad's tire. So I knew immediately he was behind it. And then when I walked around the car on the passenger side tire, there was a slash. There was a, I mean, it was slashed. So I was like, shit. Like he knows he was telling me he knows where I am and knows where I live. So I called my dad. And he was like, I'll come over. Why don't you call the police? And I was like, all right, but like we know what how this is gonna go because I don't have a restraining order. I don't have anything. Like they're gonna say there's nothing they can do. And he was like, well, just call and report it anyway. So he got there before the police did. Then I saw the police car, so I went outside and it was a young female officer and I showed her the slash tire. I said, the history and what had gone on, but that no, I didn't have a restraining order, but I was scared because I know, of the past domestic violence and that things had escalated and I hadn't given him the address and he found me. And she was just kind of like, I mean, she was empathetic, but she was like, again, right, there's nothing, there really was nothing she could do because I didn't have anything. I didn't have a restraining order. I didn't have anything like legal to give her. I had no proof. I didn't have actual footage, video of him slashing the tire. I mean, the one thing I always say is that I wish that she would have at least taken it like a little bit more of a proactive approach with it. Like she didn't ask what he looks like, what kind of car he drives, didn't take a spin sort of around the property because he was on the property, we found later. So like, had she done that, you know, I don't know if it would have stopped forever what happened, but it would have maybe stopped it that night, you know. But anyway, she was like, okay, well, here, you know, here's the record number, whatever. Go to the courthouse tomorrow to get a restraining order. And I was like, well, I've already like after the temporary, I was like, I already applied for like a restraining order like three different times, and I've been turned down three times, saying that there's not enough evidence or proof that, you know, I need one. And I don't think that this is going to be any different. She was like, well, I mean, that's what I would encourage you to do. And she left. So I went back into the apartment, and my dad was like, I'm going to go home, like to your mother. Why don't you and Will come over? You know, I can't cancel my plans, and why don't you and Will come over and we'll figure out sort of next steps of what to do now that we know that he's found you. Because my dad at that was like, oh yeah, I mean, obviously it's him. Anything crazy like that happened, he was always behind it. So my dad goes out the door, and I was standing in the doorway, and then my dad turned around and was like, Katie, call 911, Tom's here. And I looked past my dad, and I could see like the parking lot from my front door, and I saw his car pulled up next to mine, and then like the dome light went on, and I saw Tom. And so I started to call 911, and my dad was like, I'll stay out here, you go inside. And I just was uneasy about that, because, you know, my dad was like in his late 60s at that point. And I was like, I didn't want him like get any sort of confrontation, you know. So I was like, no, I was like, Dad, just come in with me. So he did, and I was in the process of talking to the 911 operator and saying that, you know, my strange husband's here. And by that point, my dad and I were on the other side of the door, and Tom was pushing in to try to like come into the apartment. And my dad and I were pushing against the door to keep it closed. And all of a sudden it was like, boom, boom, boom. And like three bullets came through the door. And this part's always like so difficult to explain, because people think they understand what that would be like, or how they would react, or how they would protect themselves somehow. But it was an ambush, first of all. Like, we didn't know that he had come there with a gun. When he was pushing against the door, like, we obviously couldn't see, so we didn't see a gun on him. And we weren't expecting this, right? And it's like, your brain goes through like, okay, what was that, you know? Like a denial almost, like, no, that wasn't what I think it was. And then it's just like fast forward. I just remember like just screaming and screaming and screaming. He pushed his way in and then shot again, and that bullet went through my right hand. I hit the floor. I remember falling on the floor and seeing like just like blood like splatter up the wall. And he was yelling, why'd you take my stuff? Why'd you take my stuff? Why did you take my military stuff? I didn't know what the fuck he was talking about. Like, he wasn't saying the things that you typically expect guys to say in this situation, like, oh, the whole thing from we were saying earlier, like, oh, if I can't have you, nobody can, or I just want us to be a family, and or you took my son from me, or, you know, I don't want this divorce. He didn't I love you too much to, none of that. It was, why did you take my stuff? And what had happened was, I had taken some of the furniture from our house when I moved into the apartment. Like, I mean, it was furniture, you know, for like us for us to live, you know, and I had paid for a lot of it. So I was like, this is what he was yelling about. And I was like, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'll return it, like that kind of stuff. And then he went over, because my dad went like left and I went right, and Will was sort of in the middle. By the way, when he shot through the door, Will was standing right behind us. So any of those bullets could have hit Will. He just shot, you know, he shot like center mass through the door. One was high, one was medium, one was low. Like any of those could have hit Will. Thank God it didn't. But like, you know, he didn't care. He didn't give a shit. He didn't give a shit that his son was in there. So he went over to my dad, and I just remember like hearing like yelling kind of, and then boom, and the gun shot again, and I heard my dad grunt, and I thought he killed him. Again, just like screaming, and I crawled from where I fell, like kind of around our kitchenette table, and Will was on the other side of the table, and Tom came over and knelt down next to him. And then he had the gun in his hand. It was this black gun, and it had a like a red laser thing on it. And he was like taunting me with it. And then all of a sudden, Will again had just turned 4, so he was still basically a like a baby, you know. He screamed out, "Don't do it, Daddy! Don't shoot, Mommy!" Which, to this day, like, I don't know how a 4-year-old would, in like active trauma, would even know or think to say that, but he did. And it got quiet. And then I heard Tom like walk into the kitchen area, which is sort of behind where I was laying. And then all of a sudden, he was like, "Kate, there's a table runner on the table, wrap the wound." So he was talking about my hand. And so I did it. And then he was like, "Kate, just go." And I could see that the door was like cracked a little bit, the front door. And so I thought, like, because the cops weren't kicking in the door and saving the day, we were just in there for, I think it wound up being like 18 to 20 minutes long. Nobody, they weren't coming in to save the day. They didn't, they, you know, I was just laying there dying. And so I thought, well, I'll either lay here and bleed out, or I can try to get out. And I honestly thought that that's when he was going to shoot me, like finish it, when I got up it to leave. But I just took the chance, and I ran out the door, and I got out and fell on the grass, and I could see the cops all lined up there in the parking lot, which I've since seen how far the grass area was from the parking lot, and it was like not far. In my trauma mind, they looked further, way further away than they actually were. And they were like, "Ma'am, can you get over to us?" And I was like, "No, I need help. I'm dying." And not one of them would just like real quick run over and grab me. And they're the ones with like bulletproof vests and guns to protect themselves. And they wouldn't come get me. So in the meantime, my dad then came out with Will. You know, what he tells is that when he was leaving, Tom said to him, "She's gone." And my dad thought that I was dead. So when we met in like on the grass, it was the first time, it was like I realized he was alive still, and he realized I was alive still. And the police were like, "Sir, can you get her over to us?"
So my dad, who had also been shot, one of them point blank, and it wound up being in his side, had to get me off the ground, and he was like, "Katie, like you've got to find your sisu," which is a Finnish word for like that extra strength and like perseverance, like the extra like I don't know something that pushes you forward. He's and I you know I knew what he meant. I got to like find it. I've got to find my legs and go. And so that's what he helped me get up, and we got over behind like the police, and I kept waiting for to hear more gunfire. I kept waiting to hear sort of the shot to know that my ex was killed, but that never came because he left. He had a gun, he had extra ammunition, he had a hunting knife, he had like a couple other like things in his pockets, like for this attack. He left everything on the counter, came out and surrendered. He surrendered at the scene and was brought in and booked into jail. They assessed me on the ground. I not only was shot through my hand, but one of the shots, probably, we think probably through one of the ones through the door, had actually gone through my left breast. So like it missed my heart somehow and just like went in one side and out the other, which is absolutely insane. And then my dad got hit in his left arm, like upper left arm, and then point blank in his left side. And like just another, I mean, miracle. Like it missed vital organs. It was in him and they had to remove the bullet, but they were able to remove the bullet and he had like no organ damage. It's like I can't explain how this happened, but I can't believe that bullets came through blindly through a door and none of us are dead. It's, I don't know. It's probably why I always speak out because I'm here to do it. So, they realized again, actually the blood, most of the blood, a lot of the blood was from the chest wound and they were really concerned, because they didn't know if the bullet was in me or not. So, I got helicoptered to like the nearest trauma unit, and my dad was able to go by ambulance. He called my mom, which this goes to the ripple effect. So it's like she wasn't there, but she's the one that got like the horrible call from her husband saying, that her ex-son-in-law had ambushed and shot her daughter, her husband. She didn't know. We didn't like the cops. Took Will, they took Will to the station. None of us, like, they didn't, my mom didn't know where her grandson was. I was in active trauma. I was in the air. I didn't know what was going on. So she had to call my brother, who then gets a horrible call. And apparently, like, he slid down the wall of his house. Like, he was, like, yeah, he was terrified, So they got my brother went to get my mom and they met us at the hospital and it was assessed that the bullet went in one side and out the other of my chest. So they were like, "It's a flesh wound, it's a flesh wound." I remember them yelling that. Like they were so happy that, that there wasn't a bullet in me and it wasn't like near my heart or anything. And then my hand was just like completely wrapped up. I don't even really remember what it looked like before the surgery. I just remember it was like limp and I thought it was going to have to be amputated. I never thought I would use my hand again. But yeah, we were, gosh, we were interviewed by police like that night because they want our statements fresh. My son was taken to the Coral Springs Police Department and interviewed by like a forensic detective. He didn't know if his mommy and his grandfather were alive or dead.
It was like, yeah, it was really intense. I had to have surgery the next morning on my hand, and I remember the surgeon being like, "I will fix your hand." And I was like, I really thought I was gonna lose it. And he was like, "No, I will fix it." And he did. It's like a miracle. And then my dad had to have surgery on his left arm, which is still pretty disabled to this day. He didn't recover as well as I did. Probably location of, and damage and age too. But we're here and we didn't lose limbs, so it's just a lot,
I am so glad that you're here to tell the story. And I sit here and I'm listening and I'm reflecting, and I remember hearing your story for the first time, and I remember sobbing, like sitting here,
Oh.
like literally sobbing. And I have come to know you and deeply inspired by the work that you do, and continue to share your voice, because there's a lot that are no longer here to share their story.
That's right. That's right.
And as somebody was watching over you at that point in time, and I firmly believe in that. And think about what you're doing now. You wrote this book, Killing Kate. What's been the feedback that you've received from that? And then what are you currently working on that people can kind of like continue to engage with your story and follow you on social media? What's next for you, like after Killing Kate? What's been that
So,
feedback, and what's next?
I mean, what I would say is that for me, even I like from my hosp like being in the hospital, I knew that I was gonna tell this story, like as much as I could, and take opportunities that I have to tell it. And because of, just like you said, there's so many that victims that don't make it, and their voices are basically silenced. And there's victims that do make it, but they're not in the same situation that I'm in, where, we did go to trial a few years after the shooting, and he was convicted and sentenced to 60 years. So at the time he was 49 in 2017 when he was sentenced, and he's not making it out of there's no option for parole. Like, he's not making it out of there. He's locked away for life. So, like, I am in a position where I'm strong enough. I've become strong enough, and I'm able to share this story and, the warning signs and what all can go sideways, and how, messed up it all still is. There's also so much like blame. I always say there's so much blame and shame still around like intimate partner violence and blaming women. And there's a lot of judgment and like misinformation about it. And so my thing with Killing Kate was that, so I'm an English major. I've been in like in editorial and marketing like my whole career so far, and I probably could have written it like fully, but myself, but it's so re-traumatizing and so triggering, and I knew I wanted to write a book, but I didn't know really how to go about it. And so I met my co-author, Elisa Devine. She found me searching for, I guess, domestic violence survivors for a book, like a compilation of stories book that she was putting together called Hashtag She Wins. And so she interviewed me for that and was so like moved and and just blown away basically by my story. She was like, this needs to be like its own book. Like, this has to be told. I would love to help you tell it. And she had never, written a memoir or, like this sort of book before. But we just kind of trusted each other and went on this process of like, I would do recordings. Like, we did an outline of my whole story, and I would do like voice recordings and, put them in a Google folder. And she spent time like writing and, capturing my voice and putting the chapters together. And I mean, she nailed it. People that read my book are like, oh my gosh, it sounds like you and your, it sounds like, you're sitting next to me telling your story. Like, she absolutely captured the way that I speak, And that's what I wanted. I wanted this as an awareness tool, and also to have in the story in one place that, people can read. And like, I'm told all the time that when people read it, they read it fast. Like, they can't put it down. And that's pretty humbling. It's definitely not boring. And it was never about like, was never about like notoriety or anything like that. I just really wanted, I think the story is compelling, and I think that a lot of people that have been through it or know people that have been through it, whether you are the victim yourself or a family member or a friend or strangers read it and are affected. So, then I've done something good in this world, the book dropped in October, so Domestic Violence Awareness Month of 2019, so just ahead of COVID. And yeah, I've gotten amazing feedback. I know of at least two colleges, like college domestic violence college programs, that are using Killing Kate like in a domestic violence class. Students read it and discuss it, and then in one of them, Elisa and I Zoom, we're going to do that soon, like early November. We're going to Zoom in with this college class and talk with the students who read the book, And it's always, I love talking with the students, because I do think it's so important to reach kind of like the younger generation. Because I'm Gen X, and like my generation, like, we didn't really hear about it, And it goes back to what I said earlier about not having sort of the language and the tools, or awareness about domestic violence. And so it's really important to me to, reach kind of like younger audiences, to help hopefully give them the, some of the awareness that they need as they're getting into these relationships, and maybe they'll think twice, or, if they see some of the patterns that they read about in the book. So that's really been big for me. Elisa and I would love Killing Kate to turn into, of course, into like a Netflix series or Hulu or a major motion picture. I think it's important, and it's got what it takes for either a series or a movie. That would be wonderful, as a next step for Killing Kate. To reach just wider audiences, and then I've done years and years of advocacy around domestic violence and gun violence and the intersection of both, and that obviously he could have attacked me in other ways. Pro-gun types like to point to, oh, he could have used a knife, he could have used a car, he could have strangled me, he could have done it. But
My thing is, no, well, he used a gun. That's the go-to. There's no going back from it. If you can't outrun a bullet. So that's why, that's why abusers often choose guns over any other way to unalive their victims. So it's just really important to me to use my voice and share my story because this is the shit that can happen. And it's preventable.
And it can happen anywhere, anytime, any place. And, oftentimes we hear about like the bigger cities like Kansas City or Orlando or Minneapolis, but it can happen in the very rural areas too. And that's something that a lot of people don't recognize. And, they move out of like these big cities. And like,
Oh,
oh,
right.
I live in like this town that has 300 people. All it takes is one person.
It's ridiculous to think, right, that it's just the big cities. I mean, where I lived in Florida wasn't like a big city. It wasn't it was like a suburb. So I don't know. Right. It can have the whole trope of oh, these things don't happen here is especially with domestic violence is complete bullshit.
Yes.
Like
Yes.
it domestic violence happens everywhere.
It does, exactly. And oftentimes it doesn't reach those headlines because we know how mainstream media is. We know this. And it's just so detrimental that in 2025, we're still battling these exact same issues that we've all been battling for decades, right? My mom's a survivor too. And that dates back to like the 70s and 80s. That goes back. And it goes back even further. Whenever we look at like policing and these systems, the way that they're set up from like the early 1900s and even before that, the systems have always been fucked. I mean, this isn't something that's
Absolutely, and it's not
brand
gotten better.
new. This
I
isn't
mean, I think
something that's brand new that just happened overnight. This, things like this takes time and
well, it only became illegal to beat your wife in the 70s, which isn't like, I mean, it's a little bit ago, but it's not, I mean, relative to, I don't know, anything, it's not that long ago, which is insane to me.
And I think if anything, with the Violence Against Women Act funding being eliminated in a lot of aspects, like the direct service providers across the country, they're deeply struggling, especially in these rural communities. And, hospitals are closing, Medicaid's being slashed, SSI is currently, being talked about being eliminated or, severely defunded. And there's a lot of these, safety net programs, like food stamps. And
Rick,
it's so horrific to sit
it's
back
like
and watch.
it is, and this country likes to pretend like, oh, the children, we care about the children. No, you don't. No, you don't. Like, you really don't. And you definitely don't care about women. Like, all of these things, like, these would be solved. Like, this is, it's crazy to me. And I guess in the grand scheme of things, my shooting's going on 13 years, which is over a decade ago, but it's not that long ago. But I
Yeah.
feel like I've been like screaming. It feels like I've been screaming about this for like decades and nothing. I don't know. It's very frustrating to me because I do get asked by, I don't know, interviewers, whatever, like, do I think things have gotten better or whatever? I'm like, no, I really don't. I don't, it's still super dangerous for women to leave their abusers. The systems are still set up to screw over victims and not protect children.
you know, putting children right back into like they're like an abusive person's hands, like just because of biology. It's like I don't understand how biology plays such a major part in parenting children. Like if he's abusive to their mother, like you're not a good father, period. End of story. Like, I don't care that you're biologically their father. And don't tell me that you're not, like, this person isn't going to negatively affect their children on some level. If not emotionally and physically abusive, well, you know, taking custody, alienating them from their mother, that sort of stuff. You know, it's like it goes on and on.
And it continues going on and on. It's
I
going to
don't know how to fix it.
continue.
I keep saying, like, I don't know how to, I want to fix it all, but I don't know how to fix it. Like, you have to, like, the family court system has to just be like bulldozed, and the judges are complicit with, I don't know. I don't know.
Exactly.
It's very
Now,
frustrating.
I want to say thank you for coming on the podcast today, and sharing your story is so deeply powerful, it's inspiring, and I strongly encourage you to keep doing it. I know you're going to.
Yep.
Because these are the conversations that we need to be having, and hearing stories like yours is what makes change. And
That's right.
more people need to hear about it. So I was really excited to hear about the college students, reading your book in different classes. I think
Love
that
it.
is.
Yep. I think it's and they always ask like such astute questions, and I don't know. I just it feel that to me feels like I'm doing something. You know, like that is like getting this conversation to like a younger audience. I
Which is the
that
generation
it's
we
another
needed.
generation, right? And you know, I and Olisa and I are both like the types where we're not like talking at them like, oh, well, we're your elders, listen to us, you know, like we're, you know, we could be we're old enough to be your mothers and whatever. Like we, you know, just meet them where they're at, like on their level. And you know, they when we do that Zoom class, it's really one of my favorite things I do each year. I hope we keep getting asked. I think it's like it might be our like fourth year this year. So, I mean, that's like a lot of students, you know? There's probably like 20-ish kids in each class, kids, young adults in each class. So, yeah, I mean, to me, that's really something concrete that can make a difference and a big reason why the book is so important to me.
Absolutely. And it sounds like it is important to a lot of other people too.
Yeah.
So again, thank you for coming on the podcast today. I greatly appreciate you, and I look forward to continuing to follow your journey and watching you to continue to grow as a survivor leader and advocate, and just continue watching you turn into more than just a survivor. Like you're just an advocate, and it's so incredibly inspiring to watch that. There's always like those pipelines going from victim to survivor, and then
Yeah.
there's activist to advocate,
That's right.
and there's different pipelines, and it's okay to be within, any one of those. And all of it's completely valid. There's a lot of reasons for why people don't share their story. That fear of rejection, the fear of not being believed. Like, I mean, look at the
Absolute,
society that we live
absolutely.
in.
I know. And
Like,
yeah, it's like, yeah. Especially
but
currently, it's like not in our favor, that's for sure, but
I do feel a glimpse of hope, and
I do.
I think people are rising up, and rising above justice. I mean, Rise Above Justice movement is not just a movement, it's a mission to
That's
get
right.
people involved, to get them, ready to understand these complex issues in our communities are so intersectional. And whenever we realize that, and we bring together our allies united against sexual and gender-based violence, and prioritizing marginalized communities and those marginalized voices, and focus on the intersectionality and prioritizing that, that's how we
Yeah.
accomplish a lot of things. But we could stay here and we could
Agreed.
talk for hours,
I know, I know.
but
We definitely could.
I greatly appreciate you, and you please take care of yourself. And
I
I look forward
will.
to talking to you very soon, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course.